Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani.
Hello, everybody. This is Ali Milani on Politics Uncensored at FUBAR Radio. We've got a packed show for you this week. We're going to talk about what must be the most boring budget anyone has ever given before an election with Rishi Sunak's party headed to what is likely a conservative defeat. Speaking to Pranesh Narayana, a research fellow at IPPR's Centre for Economic Justice. Later on, we're going to speak to Greg Swenson, chairman of the Republican Overseas. Trump is now officially, or almost officially, the Republican nominee headed into the conventions in the summer, and we're going to get a rematch of Donald Trump versus Joe Biden in November. What's that likely to look like, and how are the American public reacting to the two most unpopular candidates in history? But before we get to that, we unwrap the week. The Week Unwrapped is the part of the show where we discuss the three biggest political stories of the week. And we give listeners a roundup of the political stories they need to be aware of and some reactions to the stories. Obviously, we've had the budget this week, which is a huge issue. Jeremy Hunt has announced cuts to taxes paid by workers from April in a bid to revive Tory fortunes. There'd been a lot of noise from conservative elements as to whether inheritance tax was going to be cut. There's now a lot of noise about potentially in the Tory manifesto national insurance being cut altogether. We've got Nikki Haley ending her presidential campaign, Foreign Secretary Lord Cameron talking about Israel and Israeli Prime Minister Benny Gantz, and life on benefits, according to Liz Kendall. Joining us for the Week Unwrapped, returning this time via Zoom, is former member of the London Assembly and Labour Party member Murad Qureshi. Murad, thank you so much for joining us. How are you keeping?
I'm keeping very well, Ali. I'm sorry I didn't come in. It was just too nippy out there, so I thought I'll keep to the safety of my home and not risk the tubes.
You're protecting yourself. We're going to start off by with the budget. Jeremy Hunt has announced cuts to taxes paid by workers from April in a bid to revive the Tory fortunes. The Chancellor cut national insurance by 2p in the last reporting spring budget before the next general election. Labour said the move was a con and would leave many people worse off. The budget also includes increases to child benefit salary thresholds and a new vaping levy, while non-dom tax statuses was abolished. The 2p cut on national insurance is the second by the Chancellor for this year. Mr. Hunt argued that it would make the tax system fairer and help revive the economy. Murad, this was a boring budget.
Very clearly. I mean, the 2p reduction in national insurance, who didn't know about that? I mean, that was leaked days ago. And I think the Speaker of Parliament is probably the last person to know when he should have been the first. But no, I mean, look, it's a £20 billion deficit shortfall we're talking about, which makes scrapping the national insurance 2p thing irrelevant, quite honestly, given the shortfalls in public expenditure we're going to see for the health service, local government, as you know very well, Ali. It's making a real impact already in decisions between provision of temporary housing or social care for the elderly in our neighbourhoods up and down the country. This one is certainly not for an immediate election, in my mind. I think one thing we can certainly assume is that it's going to be later in the year as well.
Oh, that's what I was going to ask. Is there any indications, given the lack of sort of sexy items, let's say, in this budget, that, you know, there's been a lot of talk in Westminster about a May election, is now less likely given the content of this budget?
Ali, I would suggest almost certainly. The only sexy things, again, leaked days earlier, was the non-dom status being dropped. No doubt it's going to affect things like the Premiership, footballers coming over here to play for virtually not having to pay any taxes. But yeah, there was little to show, really. And it was, I mean, in light of the 14 years of a Tory government we've had, I mean, the reality is living wages have been squeezed substantially. From 2010, we have had austerity. More recently, Brexit has affected our trade with the rest of the world, particularly Europe. And now all they're promising is more austerity in the event of another term of Tory government.
So on this issue, I'm going to move on to the next story, which is one closer to home for both you and me, and that is some controversial comments that have been made, particularly by Liz Kendall. There will be no option of a life on benefits for young people under a Labour government, the party's shadow work secretary has said. Liz Kendall said Labour would invest in careers and skills training, but warned young people have a responsibility to take them up. The party said the number of people aged between 16 to 24 who are not in work, education or training is rising. A Tory spokesperson said Labour has an abysmal record on youth unemployment. According to Office for National Statistics estimates, there were 851,000 young people not in employment, education or training between October to December 2023. That number has risen by 20,000 compared to the same period in 2022 and accounts for 12% of all 16 to 24 year olds. Before we get to unemployment, training and careers, I just want to get to this comment about no option of a life on benefits. Some people have taken offense to that, given the unbelievably difficult circumstances people who are on state benefits live under. What's your reaction to the comments?
My reaction to the young people I know, I don't see any evidence of those figures at all, certainly in the parts of West London that I live in, West Central. Most young people have got aspirations, want to get on with life, and I don't think we should target them in this way, suggesting that they're not achieving and getting on with life. I think that the trick is to sort out career advice very early on in school days. I can remember that in my own school days, a bit of better advice than I would have made more of my earlier years, certainly my 20s. But nonetheless, I'm not sure what hitting young people like this is going to solve, particularly for them. And I think the critical thing is actually responding to their different needs much better. I'm not sure. I fully understand the kind of jobs that they may want in the new AI world, for example. I think we've got to adapt what's on offer, particularly outside of school and in the further education colleges up and down the country.
One of the bits that people took offence to is this idea of life on benefits and attacking people with life on benefits, because it goes to that right-wing sort of talking point that there are people in this country who are just scroungers who just live off of benefits and live off the state and they're just lazy, which is offensive, untrue. Yeah. How important is it that Labour doesn't cede too much ground in terms of the discourse and the narrative to the Tories? Because the fear is that Labour is so afraid of being challenged on this by the Conservatives that it essentially let the Tories set the narrative. Is it important for Labour to challenge this idea of scroungers and benefits and living off benefits?
Ali, I really don't see any evidence of that. I do live in a neighbourhood, Church Street in Paddington, Marylebone. I don't think people go out in their lives to seek a life on benefits. They want to go on and make progress.
Well, there's just not enough to live on to begin with.
Yeah, I mean, yes, the levels. I mean, that's what's forcing them off it anyway. The reality is the benefit system isn't helping, actually. And very often those, let's not forget the working poor. You know, a lot of people need the benefits because the wages and terms and conditions aren't what they should really be to bring them out of the benefit system. Now, I think the approach, you're right, Ali, should be quite different, and it shouldn't be a target. I think the real targets should be those who don't pay their taxes and the higher tax levels. And there are plenty of people there. And I'm sorry that the tax services aren't given the powers and the scope to do more of that. I think there have been recent studies suggesting there's potentially billions of pounds not being picked up as readily. And the focus should be on tax evasion rather than benefits. Mm-hmm. benefit to uptake.
And I just want to ask you lastly on this 851,000 young people not in employment, education or training between October to December 2023, a number that's risen by 20%, accounts for 12% of all 16 to 24-year-olds. A potential Labour government incoming, would you agree that what needs to be tackled in this is investment in careers and skills training?
Indeed. I mean, it feels to me that we haven't learned some basic basic things. I mean, I can still remember my school days, and I'm sure you can, Ali, more recently, how you would see people disappearing from the class after Easter on the last before 16. And I've never felt that we've actually put in systems to give them more vocational training. None of us are all set up to do academic qualifications, and the breadth and scope of that needs to be put in actually before 16. And people given those options very early on. Many of those people actually I've kept in touch with who left after 16. They become, you know, postmen, cabbies, working at street markets and things like this. I don't think we should neglect them and think that they've because they're not around, because they've not taken up training, they're not around. They are, and they're usually earning a living cash in hand.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to go on to our last story, and that's one that we're going to continue throughout the show, and that is that Nikki Haley has ended her presidential campaign on Wednesday after being soundly defeated in a coast-to-coast Super Tuesday contest, in effect ceding the 2024 Republican nomination to Donald Trump. This must have been the worst, most boring Super Tuesday in history. In fact, the last presidential Super Tuesday I was in California for. The former South Carolina governor, who became Trump's UN ambassador and the first prominent woman of color to seek the Republican nomination for president, declined to immediately endorse the former president, as nearly all of his other Republican rivals did. Instead, she challenged Trump to earn the support of her voters, calling it his time for choosing. "The time has now come to suspend my campaign," Haley said, and announced her decision during a 3-minute speech in Charleston, South Carolina, quite apt, that location. "It is now up to Donald Trump to earn the votes of those in our party and beyond who did not support him, and I hope he does that." Murad, reactions to Trump versus Biden 2?
Well, I mean, I'm sorry for my American relatives and other Americans. They've got the same choice as before. I've always thought of Nikki Haley as very similar to Sue Ellen Braverman here. So I wasn't particularly keen on her, but neither am I keen on Trump. And then Joe Biden, I don't think has got it all together at all. And certainly on issues like Gaza, I think he's sleepwalking into turf that he's not on top of at all. I'm not happy that the Americans have got this choice. I think there's going to be a lot of people not voting, and certainly many of my relatives in America won't even probably bother.
So I wonder if we could draw some comparisons between the states and here. There is a lot of concern that this presidential race is going to get out of hand. It's going to be particularly nasty, and is going to be an issue for democracy itself in America.
Yeah.
Equally, in the UK, there's a lot of people concerned at the nature of the next general election we're going to go into, given the culture wars that are being stoked, attacks on refugees, migrants, Muslims, LGBT people. How concerned should we be in the West around the strength of our democracy and the kind of elections that we're going to be running?
Well, Ali, I was struck by the first line of the budget speech yesterday. He spoke about £1 million being given to a Muslim memorial for the war dead. And I think that's largely a response into the Islamophobia allegations which stuck on the Tories last week. So, yes, I think we're going to see more of it. It's going to creep into things like normally boring stuff like budgets and things like this. And in the States, quite honestly, I personally think the Americans are nearer to a civil war than they realise, unfortunately. The way Trump and Biden now fight this battle will be intriguing. There's a lot of latent nationalistic feelings which Trump prods very, very easily.
Yeah, I mean, the Americans...
I'm not sure it's good news for the world.
The American citizens are the most divided they've been at any time since the Civil War. That's true. But that rise in the far-right nationalistic politics isn't one that we're immune to here in Europe. We've seen the rise of far-right sort of nationalist governments and political parties across Europe. Are you concerned that we could see that here in the UK?
I am certainly, Ali, like yourself. It's been exported from the States as well, quite clearly, the cultural wars. I think there are British politicians and advisors basically copying what's happening in the States. That's been the case for a long time. When I used to travel regularly between North America and London, it was obvious, cultural things like pop used to come over. Now it's the political culture, and I don't think it's a healthy thing. We've got different traditions and different makeups of people that we have to respond to. But it's going to be a tough one to stop and challenge, as well as what's happening in mainland Europe, in Holland and in France particularly.
Last question for you, Murad. Dave Rowntree, the drummer for Blur, has been selected as a Labour candidate in the next general election. He's the second musician to do so. Is Labour setting up a new band, and will you be the lead singer?
Well, listen, I do know David. He stood in my ward, Church Street,
in
a by-election. But he actually, it was a by-election, unfortunately, he lost. Look, he's a working-class lad, made good. I don't knock him for that and having ambitions. Maybe there's a story there. I think that's the story rather than him being a famous pop star.
But he's the second one to have been selected, so I wonder if there's something behind the scenes happening.
There's a pattern. I mean, personally, I don't think the Joe Strummers of the world from The Clash would have done that kind of stuff. But, you know, that's their choice. And nor Bob Marley.
You're dodging my question as to whether you're going to be the lead singer there.
Well, look, I have had a record named after me, so...
You have to expand on that. What do you mean you've had a record named after me?
There's an EP called Murad Qureshi. If you check I once funded someone to publish a record, and would you believe it, he named it after me because he was amazed that I would back him.
There we go. So everybody go and search Murad Qureshi's music.
And knowing the music industry a bit, I'm not going to take up that offer. I think I'm getting a bit too old for it.
Oh, well, we'll see what. Maybe come conference time, me and you can share a karaoke stage.
Okay, that
was Murad Qureshi. Thank you so much, Murad, for joining us. Former member of the London Assembly and Labour Party member, talking us through the week unwrapped and the stories. There's a lot of stories this week to touch on. We've talked about. Nikki Haley ending her presidential campaign. Going to be joined later on by Greg Swanson, a chairman of the Republican overseas. We're going to speak to him about his take on the election results and what is likely to happen at the next presidential election. We've spoken about some of the controversial comments made by Liz Kendall. She's received a lot of grief about this, particularly today from Labour members, because this idea that no option of a life on benefits kind of plays into the right-wing narratives that there are people in the country who are basically scroungers and lazy and choose to live on benefits when the amount given to people on benefits is basically unlivable and pushes people into poverty. The story around youth unemployment has kind of been buried under that. We've also had Foreign Secretary Lord Cameron having told Israeli Prime Minister Benny Gantz that the flow of aid into Gaza must increase. Lord Cameron told Mr. Gantz, a retired general and member of Israel's war cabinet, that we are still not seeing improvements on the ground. The two met in central London on Wednesday afternoon. The Foreign Secretary stressed that Israel, as the occupying power in Gaza, had a legal responsibility to ensure the availability of aid. We saw some shocking scenes of and allegations of Israeli troops turning fire onto Palestinian civilians going after aid that's still under investigation, so we can't comment on whether that on the particularities of that case, but obviously huge concern from the international community. But next we are going to be talking about the budget. So we spoke to Murad first thing around the budget, including things like cuts to the national insurance, the non-dom tax, as well as other things. Joining me next to talk about the budget is Pranesh Narayanan, a research fellow at IPPR's Center for Economic Justice. We're going to break down this very, very boring budget after these messages.
Follow us at Politics Uncensored UK for more from the show.
FUBAR Radio presents
What the Health with Gabby Allen.
Joining me now is Millie Gooch, author and founder of Sober Girl Sobriety Society. I need to know what is so bad about dating sober.
I think it's just terrifying when it's something that you're not used to, because when I was drinking and dating, you know, like, you use it to calm your nerves, you use it for confidence, you rely on it. And I think that's the one thing I realised when I stopped drinking, is how much I really relied on alcohol. I was always kind of saying, you know, like, oh, I'm not dependent on it, but for my confidence I was really. But I also think there's so many benefits to it. Like, I used to go on so many dates when I was drinking, I'd be like, they are the one, and then I'd meet them like a few weeks later sober and I'd be like, we've got nothing in common, what was going through my mind? I'd be like, oh, it was because I was drunk.
Access all areas with Bobby Norris.
Heartbreak, how are you, my love?
I'm great, thank you. How are you?
It looks fun in there.
I want to talk about this because obviously you met your partner on The Apprentice. When did you start to get that feeling, I'm into him and this is more than just a banter or a friendship? Because it's a close environment being on a show like that, isn't it?
I really wish I could sit here and give loads of juicy gossip. Actually, we used to secretly meet in the laundry room on the show, but we didn't. And when I actually last spoke with yourselves, I think it was right after I'd won, we weren't even flirting, never mind dating. First time that I thought I actually fancied him was when I watched him on TV and I watched episode one.
How funny.
Hang on. You know, he's actually really good looking.
Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani.
And joining me in the studio, we have Deputy Leader of the Green Party, Zach Polanski. Zach, thank you so much for joining us. How are you keeping, Zach?
I'm great. Thanks for having me. How are you?
So you're hoping for four MPs in the general. You think that's going to happen?
Yeah, that's absolutely the minimum at what we're
I don't want to be Piers Morgan here, but will you take I don't have £1,000, but you take a £100 bet with me that you'll get four MPs?
Well, I do everything in politics to talk about the harms of gambling. So for me to place a bet on there would be pretty, you know, pretty horrendous.
Before we had you on, we discussed with the producers as to whether I should do the bet joke, and I said I would because I had every faith that you would answer it in the way I expect a politician of any moral
standing. We should also talk about cryptocurrency, which also is very problematic.
Rishi, if you're listening, mate, that's how you answer a betting question.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio. FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio presents.
So we have got the incredible Sunita.
How does Sunita whittle down the people she wants to talk to the people she doesn't? What's your criteria?
Well, you've got to be an adult.
Okay.
That's always a good start.
Always a good start. But when I'm an adult, not just like 18, you've got to be like not young enough to be my child. You have to ideally be London-based, because I am. Yeah. Although I don't mind if you've got a country pad, that would be nice.
So at the minute we're going with age and location are important.
Age and location are good.
Every Friday from 6 p.m.
FUBAR Radio.
Welcome back. This is Ali Milani at Politics Uncensored on FUBAR Radio. We're just joined by Murad Qureshi as we spoke about this week's news. And Budget Week is always about the budget. And this budget in particular had a lot of eyes on it, as it was the what was perceived to be the last budget before a general election. I'm just going to go through some of the headlines of what we saw in the budget. Given its results, there are now a lot of people who are questioning whether this is the last budget before the general election. Boring is the word that was most frequently used in Westminster. But some of the summaries are that Jeremy Hunt, the Chancellor, cut workers' national insurance by another 2p in the budget, meaning it falls from 10% to 8%. He says the cut to begin next month is worth £450 a year for the average worker. And also increased the child benefit threshold from £50,000 to £60,000. Labour leader Keir Starmer calls the budget a last desperate act, with people paying more and more for less and less. New official forecasts say the government will collect 37.1p per pound of GDP in 2028-29, the highest levels in nearly 80 years. Joining me now via Zoom is Pranesh Narayanan, a research fellow at IPPR's Centre for Economic Justice. Pranesh, thanks so much for joining us. What are your initial reactions to this budget?
So, I mean, I think you summed up quite well with that one word of boring. But I think we've been calling it a slash and crash budget. Basically, the Chancellor's cutting taxes, slashing taxes today, and that's going to crash public services tomorrow. So I think that's a real story. But really, it's been quite a boring statement. Most of the details got leaked before we even saw Jeremy Hunt's speech, and there was no real big surprises in the speech itself. So yeah, I think it broadly quite a desperate attempt to play politics with the nation's finances.
Can you unpack a little bit? I'll be honest, man, most people that when we talk about the budget, people are just bored, right? There's usually someone puts up a calculator somewhere of what does it mean to you, and everybody goes on there to figure out what does it mean, but no one actually cares. Like, I mean, they care, but they don't pay attention to the details of what's going on, largely because our politicians are such bad orators. But I'm not going to focus on that today. What do you mean by slash and crash? What is that actually, like, if you could unpack that a little bit for us?
Yeah, sure. So I mean, everyone, let's just start with the sort of crash part, right? So everyone uses public services. You know, 9 out of 10 people have used or know someone who's used the NHS. You know, police, schools, housing, all of this stuff is provided by the government, right? And your tax revenues fund all of that. And so what they're doing, when I say it's a slash and crash budget, they've slashed taxes now, and they're slashing funding for all of these services in the future. So that's sort of what I mean when I say slash and crash budget. Now, why am I saying that they're cutting spending? That's because the government actually doesn't have any detailed spending plans beyond next year. So the way this works is that every few years, the government sort of gets together all the departments and they come up with plans for how they're going to spend the money that they need to sort of deliver all the services that politicians want them to deliver. The sort of last review got done back in 2021 and ends in this year. So beyond that, they haven't done any of these detailed spending plans. And you know, this is like quite boring stuff really for most people, but it's really important because it sort of sets out how the government's actually going to spend its money. Now, what the Treasury are doing instead, because there's going to be an election this year and politicians don't want to sort of commit to anything before an election spending wise, is they've said, all right, we're just going to sort of come up with a figure for how much overall spending is going to look like over the parliament, over the next few years, sorry. And they've just sort of said, all right, we'll pluck a number out of thin air and we're not going to sort of say how any of that money is going to be spent. But we're still going to cut taxes. And so the taxes they've cut today are actually taking money out of public services in the years sort of after next year, basically, because they haven't fixed these plans down, and the amount that they're saying spending is going to sort of increase is too little. You know, the day-to-day spending on sort of public services is going to be cut by about 17% for departments that aren't sort of protected. You've got the health department, education department, and defense. The government has said, yeah, okay, we're definitely not going to cut spending on those things. But actually, you've got a whole host of other departments which they've said, well, okay, we're not going to protect them. So you've got, you know, transport, you've got local government, councils are really struggling right now. And you've got all sorts of, you know, environmental stuff that DEFRA does, like all of these places, all of these services are sort of, you know, they could get the chop because the government just hasn't fixed any spending plans and they've done tax cuts. So, you know, this is a sort of long-winded way of saying that they're not committing to any spending plans and they're assuming that these tax cuts are just going to sort of do something to the economy to improve it, but I don't see how it's going to really improve things.
I think what most of Westminster was expecting was some sort of giveaway. Traditionally, or the conventional way of thinking is that the last budget before a general election, there's some sort of giveaway by the government who wants to get re-elected, addressing some of the key issues of the day. And if we look at polling, it's clear that the issue people care about specifically are the economy, the cost of living crisis, just making it week by week, wage stagnation, the NHS waiting times clearly are an issue, the issue around transport around the country and the transport links around the country and the infrastructure, as well as the war in Gaza and Ukraine are some of the key issues. Not really touched that at all. Why haven't they this isn't a traditional, you know, this seems like a budget that you might get in the middle of a term, not at the end, looking to get re-elected. Do you have any sense as to why it's so boring?
I think they're really hemmed in by the overall position of the economy. And they've got this sort of obsession with tax cuts and they can't really think beyond that. So politically, Jeremy Hunt is sort of really constrained, is being really unimaginative because his backbench MPs and, you know, members of the Tory party are just sort of so adamant that we need tax cuts before an election. That's the giveaway that they want to see and they don't think is going to win them the election. So they're going ahead with this sort of, you know, quite boring tax cut of 2p off national insurance because that's all they've got. They don't want to crash the economy like Liz Truss did by announcing a huge unfunded set.
So is it a sort of do no more harm to the economy?
I think, yeah, do no more harm, but still try and give some of these people what they want, which is tax cuts. I think that's broadly. Yeah.
Some of the narrative coming out of it has been particularly on national insurance. It seems like the ambition from Rishi Sunak and others is to abolish national insurance altogether or roll it into the income tax. Can I get your response to that? I mean, you're laughing straight away, but that seems to be their attack point, is that national insurance should be gotten away with. It should either be rolled into income tax or eliminated altogether.
So, I mean, Hunt already almost rode back on that this morning by saying that, oh, you know, maybe we can't actually cut income national insurance altogether. And actually, we worked out just today that if you cut national insurance altogether, if you just did away with it, you would basically be cutting the entire defense budget almost the entire defense budget, and definitely more than the transport budget. So everything the government spends on sort of buses, trams, trains, cars goes immediately if you do that.
And that's on some ideological position on
it's kind of an absurd thing. And I feel like, you know, so people have really been challenging the Labour Party on their, you know, £28 billion investment pledge, and they sort of, there was a lot of pressure on them to scrap that because everyone was saying, oh, I was going to increase borrowing. Well, Hunt was just about to, she was basically announcing a policy that would leave them £49 billion sort of in the red. And it's crazy. It's literally like it's Trussonomics all over again. Just they just want to sort of, it seems like they want to signal that they're still sort of tax cutting sort of Tories.
Well, they are getting a lot of pressure on Trussonomics from Truss. I mean, she'll stand on any stage that anyone gives her. I think I saw her at the corner of my street giving a speech somewhere about how she was pushed out of Downing Street. You mentioned Labour's response. I want to focus on that now, if that's okay. Keir Starmer used the term maxing out the country's credit card. And that seems to be the sort of narrative that he's going with, that the Tories are destroying the economy before he gets into government. That has received a lot of pushback from economic circles, even Labour circles. Some called it economically illiterate. And it's this narrative often people paint about being able to balance your own checkbook is the same as balancing the country's checkbook. I think I heard an American commentator once say something to the effect of saying, you know, using the terms credit card or maxing out the credit cards or balancing the country's checkbook like you do your own personal finances is the equivalent of saying I can parallel park versus landing on the moon. And that's how different the two things are. What do you make of Labour's response and the criticism Keir Starmer's getting, including being called economically illiterate, which I thought was strong?
It does seem quite strong, but I would say, you know, I myself was quite disappointed with that kind of response. It wasn't totally unexpected. They're trying to use these sort of easy metaphors to sort of win political points, but actually it is quite misleading. It's not really how the government works. And I think
I hate to interrupt you, but can we just on this show just put an end, can you give your response to this balancing your own checkbook versus balancing the country's checkbook? And
it's a political choice what you do in terms of spending and taxing, right? So it's not like balancing a checkbook. A country can, you know, issue its own currency. A house, you know, you can't balance your checkbook by...
I've tried issuing my own currency in my house. Yeah, no one else will take it. It
doesn't really work very well, but the government can do that. You know, it has the power to borrow for, you know, literally hundreds of years. It's got crazy amounts of tools at its disposal to manage its finances, and it's not just balancing the checkbook. That's a political choice, you know. And actually, I would say there's certain things that, that Hunt did in this budget that sort of points to the sort of things you would do if you were trying to improve the country. If you weren't, you know, if you weren't playing by this sort of maxing out the credit card type politics, was the sort of increase in tax on non-doms and the increase in tax on, you know, oil and gas windfall profits was a great example of that, because there are definitely ways to raise money for the government to provide public services without putting...
Can we touch on that quickly, Pranesh? I want, because you're an expert in the field, and we always talk about on this show, other shows, politics in general, the NHS needs more money, transport needs more money, childcare needs more money. And obviously, money isn't the only solution to these things. There's administration issues, there's infrastructure issues, there's all sorts of issues. But let's focus on the money for now. All of these departments would say that they could run a better, more efficient service for the people of this country with more money. I'm not asking you to advocate for these things, but give our listeners a quick, who might not be in the economics world, what could the government do to raise this money? What are some of the areas that they could tackle? You've talked about non-dom and other things, but just give them a general overview. So, how could we raise some of this money to then, if we wanted to, if we had the political will to give them into public services, where could it come from?
So, I mean, one big thing that we've been advocating for is sort of finding ways to tax wealthy people more, because they need to pay their fair share. They pay far lower rates of tax than your average household. So capital gains tax is a big one, I think.
What is that?
So capital gains tax is a tax on the profit you make from selling sort of stocks and shares, or from selling a second home, things like that. Things, sort of financial assets, you know.
So when you make money with money, basically.
Yeah, exactly. When you make money with money and you sell it off, that's where you get taxed through capital gains tax, and capital gains tax rates are much lower. It's a bit complicated. There's sort of different rates for different types of assets, but basically, you could raise money by raising either the rate of capital gains tax or getting rid of some of the loopholes that are in that system. Mm-hmm. So, for example, in this budget, Hunt just cut the amount of tax you paid on the money you made from selling a second home. You could increase that as a start, and then you could just increase the rates on other things. There's also sort of loopholes for people who sell business assets. So if they own a business and if they've owned it for a certain amount of time, they can sort of sell it without paying capital gains tax. And, you know, some people say that, oh, you need that for entrepreneurship, but I think, you know, the evidence on that is actually quite weak. So that's one way. There's another way, which is about sort of, you've got all these companies who, the oil and gas companies, but in particular over the last few years, but many companies do this, but they sort of, when they make big bumper profits, they do these things called share buybacks, which are basically, they take a lot of their profits and they buy back their own shares, which is basically a way of giving money to their shareholders without actually paying any tax on it. Mm-hmm. Or they pay a little bit of tax on it, but it's not a huge amount.
Right.
And what we're saying is you could increase the amount you tax that as well, and that would stop, that would tax the basically a huge flow of money from sort of ordinary people who are using, like, you know, energy.
Yeah.
Stopping the flow of money from them to sort of wealthy shareholders.
Appreciate it. Thank you so much. That was a really interesting discussion with Pranesh Narayanan, research fellow at IPPR Center for Economic Justice. Pranesh, thank you so much for joining us discussing this budget. We're going to shift quickly to the Americas, as Nikki Haley has lost the primary, and Donald Trump is going to be our next president. I had a discussion earlier today with Greg Swenson, chairman of the Republican Overseas. So Nikki Haley has officially pulled out of the presidential race, meaning we are likely to see a rematch of Donald Trump versus Joe Biden this autumn in the presidential race in the United States. We have spoken about this on the program previously. We had a journalist on who referred to it as the race that no one wants to see. In a speech on Wednesday, Haley refused to endorse Trump, but congratulated him and said he must earn the votes of the people who do not support him. It comes as the Supreme Court has ruled on Monday that states cannot kick Donald Trump off the ballot for his actions over January 6th. And we are now headed full steam ahead into conference season with the two nominees known to most of us, unless there's something extraordinary happens between now and then. Joining me now is Greg Swenson, chairman of Republican Overseas. Greg, thank you so much for joining us. Can I get your initial reactions to, I think, what everybody expected, and that is Donald Trump is going to be the next Republican candidate?
Yeah, no surprises there. I mean, it was probably the least exciting Super Tuesday in generations, or maybe ever. And so, you know, the outcome was pretty obvious going back now to for the last year, really. So if you'd asked me a year ago, I might have believed it, but I was hoping that it would be someone else besides Trump. And, you know, I was actually behind Ron DeSantis. And Ali, if you look back a year ago, at this time in 2023, you know, Ron DeSantis was up 2 points in the CNN poll. I think in the Real Clear averages, you know, he was down to Trump maybe 5 or 10 points. But once the indictment started, it really made it terribly difficult for any other candidate to get traction. You know, DeSantis was doing pretty well, and you know, he was probably at 35, and Trump's at 40. But once the indictments started coming out, you know, the first one was Alvin Bragg in New York. Trump went up 15 points. All of that came from DeSantis, so that's a 30-point swing, and it's been that ever since.
And so, why do we think that is? Because he has pretty much blown everyone out of the water as it pertains to competition. You're referencing the indictments that are happening all across different states. So you think there's a bit of blowback in that people are rallying behind him, or Republicans are rallying behind him because of what are they perceiving it to be politically natured, these indictments and these legal challenges?
Yeah. Absolutely. In fact, you know, people sometimes would say, you know, he's gone up in the polls in spite of the indictments. It's not in spite of, it's absolutely because of. And it's created a lot of, you know, there is the dedicated base, right? He's got 25% of Republicans that are, you know, we're really behind him no matter what. But you had a lot of people that were open to Trump, but open to other candidates. They were starting to lean toward DeSantis. This is before Nikki started really getting traction. And so much of that core, you know, that persuadable base really just gravitated to Trump once the indictment started. And you saw what happened with the mugshot. You know, he raised $7 million the next morning after the famous mugshot. You know, that's really what's driving it. And I can point to one other example, Ali. Is a year, the summer of 22, if you remember, in August of 22 is when the FBI raided President Trump's home in Mar-a-Lago. And they, you know, unannounced, and surprise to everybody. But at that time, the week before, Trump was polling 9 points above DeSantis. And this is, by the way, DeSantis before the great midterm reelection that Ron had in November of 22, you know, where he won by 20 points in Florida. And that's what really propelled him in late 22 and early 23. But this is back in the summer of 22. And Trump's up 9 points. They raid Mar-a-Lago. Same poll the next week had Trump up 39. So it's, again, that 30-point swing that's really difficult to counter, given, you know, the rallying of voters around Trump because they felt like he was, you know, victimized. They felt like the justice system was weaponized. And I think you can make a pretty good argument that is in fact the case.
And so, I mean, that's certainly true and seems to be true of Republican voters and Republicans swaying behind him. He's now headed into a general election where he's going to have to win independents, and we know all too well, I've worked in US presidential elections, you have an enormous amount of experience in them as well. It's those independent voters that he's going to have to win. He's headed into a general election as one of the, if not the most unpopular candidates in history. He's currently polling 53%, I think, give or take, unfavorability ratings, which is very, very high. Joe Biden is also polling, you know, no president has been re-elected from his approval ratings either. So the American public are really facing two very, very unpopular, generally, according to polls, candidates.
No doubt.
What kind of path does he have to the presidency, given his unfavorabilities? What does he have to do?
Yeah, so great question. And you're absolutely right. You know, the big mystery when Trump started getting this bump, this elevation from the indictments, the big question has always been, well, great, that's helping with Republicans against my, you know, against what I had hoped for. I was supporting DeSantis. But so it was very frustrating for those of us who were behind Governor DeSantis. But so then the question is, how does that affect him in the general? So my answer over the last year has always been the Democrats want him to be the candidate. They want to face Trump. They don't want to face DeSantis or Nikki or anyone else. So they'll keep up with these indictments. There were ultimately four criminal indictments, plus the civil cases, plus the mugshot, and then the attempts to remove him from the ballot. These have all helped him. But I'm starting to change my view a little bit. I'm starting to think that this might even help him in the general election. It won't help him as much. He's not going to pick up 30 points, God knows. But, you know, people are in the middle, independents, undecideds, are starting to see this as a, you know, a true use of lawfare, and they don't like it. And if you look at the polling, the attempts to keep him off the ballot have not polled well at all. The Democrats rallied around Biden, but so much that the Democratic Party kept his opponents, Dean Williams, Dean Phillips and Marianne Williamson, off the ballot in North Carolina and Florida. So these are things that, you know, you could argue are not very democratic. They're not very constitutional. I think that, you know, this, so I think people, the indictments won't hurt him as much as I had thought, you know, 6 or 12 months ago. And also people are looking at Joe Biden's problems too. You know, he's got some issues with, you know, with Hunter and the family business and the influence peddling racket that you could argue the Biden clan is. So there, you know, some of these things that were so negative for Trump are now, I wouldn't say positives necessarily for him, but they're being offset by the same problems that Biden has. The document case, for example, I mean, both have real problems with the documents. So, and then you pointed out something really well, Ollie, and it goes to my argument that the best thing Trump has going for him is Biden. Because Trump, as you said, is his negatives, his disapproval rating, 53, 54, but Biden's is 59, and Trump's approval rating is 44, while Biden is only 38. So Trump is minus 10 in approval, Biden is minus 21. Now, normally incumbents, and they both are kind of incumbents, Trump is a quasi-incumbent, you know, historically, no one gets reelected with their negatives over 50. But then again, they're both over 50. They're both very unpopular. And it's just a matter of, it's become the election, Ollie, of who do you dislike less?
Yeah, and this is, and we had an American journalist on our show a couple of weeks ago who said this is really the election that nobody wants in America between two deeply unpopular candidates. I want to ask you, look, we don't know what will happen in the election, and it's likely to be a tumultuous one. How concerned are you in two parts? Firstly, with the nature of this election, we've got Donald Trump who, at best, is a wild card. We've got all sorts of legal cases above it. Two very deeply unpopular candidates. America has always presented itself as a pillar of democracy around the world. How concerned are you around the kind of election we're going to get between now and November?
Yeah, great question, Ollie. I'm very concerned, like I think most Americans are, or at least most Americans that follow this stuff or pay attention to it. And so it's definitely an issue. And that's why, in many ways, whether it's Trump or Biden, I hope they win comfortably. I hope, you know, I hope they win by 10 points and preferably Trump in my case. But, you know, a close election is going to be very difficult. And remember, you know, prior to the 2020 election, the in Washington and New York, all the big cities were literally boarding up their storefronts, okay, in downtown areas and in shopping districts, right? They're boarding up, you know, private entrepreneurs with little cafes were boarding up their windows. And now that's not because they were worried about the loonies that stormed the Capitol on Jan 6. And by the way, that was disgraceful, so I'm surely not advocating that. But they were worried about Trump winning. And they were looking back at the summer of 2020 with all the unrest and the violence and destruction in the cities around the country, and thinking, if we thought that, you know, the BLM riots were bad in the summer of 20, if Trump wins, the leftists, the Antifa, the BLM, they're going to go crazy in the streets. Now it turns out that Biden won, so there was no violence. They took the boards down. Everything was cool. But then, of course, you had January 6th, which really took the sort of moral high road away from the Republicans in many ways. So, obviously, nobody wants to see any of this stuff. But when you, so I'm worried about it. I hope that if Trump wins, he wins by 5 or 10 points, and it's not close. Because if it's close, yeah, it's going to be ugly.
And I'm going to ask you just quickly, as just an American, how concerned you are about Trump. You've just said, I mean, I know he wasn't your favorite candidate and Ron DeSantis was, but yeah, you've just said that you prefer him to win. I wonder how much you give credence to the argument that Trump himself is a threat to American democracy. He's someone who has been accused of encouraging January 6th. He's someone who, for example, scenes out of Charlotte where he said there were very good people on both sides. He in the past has threatened his political rivals with prison himself. And for us abroad, you know, if we were to take the name in the country out and just look at the behavior, he better resembles a dictator from the third world than he does an American president. How concerned are you at the risk of a Trump presidency, given everything that's happened to him, the anger that he'll walk into the White House with, and the future of the Constitution and American democracy?
Yeah, no, all valid questions. I wish I had a notepad, because you hit on a lot of things there, Ali, so you might have to refresh me. But look, what Trump says is sometimes, you know, really escalates. What Trump often says is inflammatory, and that's uncool. Like, I don't advocate that. I think words matter, and I wish he would dial it down. I wish he wasn't so unfiltered. And I think he makes mistakes with his unfiltered rhetoric, right? But then you got to look at what he does. And so, you know, obviously Jan 6 was disgraceful, right? So by encouraging them to you know, go down and protest, but I have to remind you, he did say peacefully and patriotically. I don't think he would have, I mean, obviously them storming the Capitol does not help Trump, right? That was a disaster for him. And so, you have to look at what he does, not what he says. And anytime, the other thing I find amusing about this whole threat to democracy thing and the institutions, first of all, the institutions all worked in his last administration. Whenever he tried to go too far or off the grid, the institutions were there and they worked and they functioned and everything worked out. Secondly, you know, they said the same thing about him in 2016. You know, this is the end of democracy. He's going to be a dictator. He's an authoritarian. None of that happened. He actually governed respectably. You know, I was worried he'd actually be more of a populist and try to gin up the troops all the time, gin up the, you know, the base. And yes, he still does that and with his rhetoric. But, you know, how he governed was actually right down the middle of traditional Republican playbook.
So
the institutions were fine. I don't think there's any.
I mean, Greg, again, I think
they said the same thing 4 years ago.
I think in terms of the institutions working well, I think you're right. I actually think the Trump presidency is a little bit of an advert for the American institutions because they withstood that pretty well. But he did push them. He did push them pretty hard, particularly post the election. And this is where the threat to democracy comes from. It was the first time in, certainly in my lifetime, I think ever, that an American president or an American candidate who had lost the election just outright refused to acknowledge the results, pushed at best, I mean, conspiracy theories about the rigging of the election, and I mean, you quite rightly said words matter. They do matter because democracy is based on faith, the faith that, you know, people believe that their votes will be counted and that the governed are governed only by the consent of the majority. While the polls suggest that the majority of Republicans and a huge percentage of the American population don't believe Joe Biden is a legitimate president because he didn't win. So his words did have an impact on the democracy. Yeah. And I wonder how much more America could take.
Yeah, Al, I think, first of all, you're absolutely right. So I surely won't dispute that. And I wouldn't argue anything, I wouldn't argue at all that January 6th was anything but a disgrace, right? So, but I do think that again, the institutions work. He did make some mistakes with his rhetoric. He did leave office peacefully. I mean, you know, if you ignore Jan 6th for a second, but he did, you know, he did peacefully leave. If that was an insurrection, I wouldn't bet on insurrections anymore because it was a bunch of idiots with biking helmets running around without guns, you know. So I think.
But they were given thumbs up by quite a few politicians, even on their way out of the White House.
Again, a bunch of loonies, in my view. And I think Joe Biden made a really nice comment on January 6th. He said that doesn't represent America. It doesn't represent Republicans. So. So I thought that was well received, and that's kind of an example of someone.
Greg, I don't have you for long. I want to ask you a less partisan question, if I may. Yeah. Again, as an American, we've got a candidate who's 77 years old, will be 78 by the time he takes office. Another one who's 81. We did a whole show around Joe Biden's mental faculties, if you will. Yeah. In fact, my favorite quote was, "I'm Joe Biden and I've forgotten this message," which I thought was kind of funny, but also extremely concerning given that he's going to be commander in chief. How concerned are you at the age of both candidates?
Oh, absolutely concerned. I mean, you know, Joe Biden's cognitive issues are so obvious, and it's just disrespectful to the voters, to Americans, that the Biden inner circle acts like that's completely untrue and there's nothing wrong. I mean, it's just kind of, they lose credibility for sure.
But Donald Trump isn't far behind.
Trump is not young. So I think that Trump wisely, as he understands that. And I think his vice presidential pick, his running mate pick, will be all the more important. Usually nobody really cares who the vice president is. It's always overhyped as it
never actually has an impact
process.
On the vote.
This time, I think it's really serious. And that it'll also be an electoral advantage. If Trump can be perceived as someone who has a running mate who can take over immediately if Trump, you know, keels over, then that's a big advantage because Biden does not have that because he's got Kamala Harris who polls below Biden and nobody has confidence in her. So I think, look, I think it's an issue for both candidates. If you look at the polling, Trump polls much better on the age and cognitive issue than Biden, but that doesn't mean 78 is, you know, a young spring chicken.
Mm-hmm. I mean, he would be the age that Biden is now in office if he were to get elected.
No, absolutely.
And Greg,
so I think it's serious.
Last one, mate. I want a prediction from you. Who do you think is going to be Trump's running mate?
If I had to pick one, I'm going to go out on a limb.
Not who you'd want. Who do you think he's going to pick?
I think he's going to pick Robert O'Brien.
Oh, you think so? Okay.
Yeah. Now, that flies in the face of conventional wisdom that he has to pick a woman or a person of color. But why would the Republicans want to get into that same ditch of identity politics that the Democrats are stuck in? I would just say pick the best person. I don't care if he's white or black or male or female. So I happen to think that would be a kind of a surprise pick. Because nobody knows who he is. He was the national security advisor at the end of Trump's administration back in 19 and 20.
Yeah, and I think given that he was national security advisor, that might be a pick to reassure the country and the Republican base that if anything were to happen to Trump, at least because often a lot of times with the presidency, very different to our system here, security and foreign policy are you know, what you need to reassure your supporters on. I'm going to go with Tim Scott. I think he's going to pick Tim Scott. I think.
I think that'd be a wise choice. And again, not because he's black. I just think Tim Scott is a patriot and he's got a great story, great background, and he's an optimist. He's more of a sunny optimist like Reagan was. as opposed to Trump, who's all about revenge.
Well, I think he'd be able to, he'd probably be able to stump better for Trump as well in the election.
I think, Ali, I would definitely put Tim Scott on the short list.
All right, thank you so much, Greg. I'm going to definitely invite you, hopefully have you back on the show closer to the election, and we'll see as things unfold.
I'd love to come into the studio. I just couldn't make it today.
Yeah, we'd love to have you in. That was Greg Swenson, chairman of the Republican Overseas. We're going to come back after this short break and look forward to next week's show. Join me after this break.
Follow us at Politics Uncensored UK for more from the show.
Thank you to Greg Swenson for that really interesting discussion around the presidential elections. I want to thank all of our guests for a really packed show. We talked about the budget with Pranesh Narayanan, research fellow at IPPR's Centre for Economic Justice. Greg Swenson, again, chairman of the Republican Overseas, and Murad Qureshi, former member of the London Assembly, who spoke to us about this week's news. Join us next week for another jam-packed show talking about politics across the UK. You can follow us at Politics Uncensored UK on Twitter, now known as X, on Instagram and on TikTok. You can find me at Ali Milani UK, again on TikTok, on Instagram and on Twitter. You can listen to all of our previous shows on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, and all good shows. See you next week. Salams.